This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Let me first say that I really enjoy being here. It's a pleasure and an honour to attend this symposium and to give a contribution. And I also would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this area. Today I like briefly to talk about ways Yolngu people classify, develop and transfer knowledge and meaning. And to do that I zoom in on one clan and use its song lines as a starting point. The Arnhem Land expedition not only collected a great many examples of Aboriginal art and material culture, but also presented vast collections of plant and animal life, all classified according to our Western scientific categories, as first laid down by Linnaeus in his Taxonomy of the Natural World. In my presentation, I will try to concentrate on indigenous system of classifying knowledge. Well, contrary to Western thinking, in which plant specimen, fish, birds and animals are separate entities, Aborigines connect species that are separated in this type of Linnaeus taxonomy and use them as metaphors in a philosophy that defines space, time, cosmology, economy and social structure. These various layers of meaning are encoded in dreamtime travels of ancestors and in mythological stories, especially in sequences of songs and acted out also in the choreography of dances. And this is how Indigenous Australians store, develop and pass on knowledge. In Arnhem Land, this corpus of knowledge is mediated through a number of dreamings or totems or mythological beings, and these dreamings of each clan comprise what I've called a dreaming cluster. And to explore this advanced type of taxonomy, I would like to turn to one of the clans I have become most familiar with during my fieldwork, and that is the Wurukikanya clan of the Jinang-speaking people living south of Milingimbi on the mainland. And the Wurukikanya dreaming cluster consists of the following species. Now I try to find.
Click
view 9. What you see here may appear to be a random list of animals, plants, a type of weather, and spiritual beings. And that's exactly what I thought when I first heard the song lines listing these themes. But when you look closer, there is a strict logic or rationale to these clusters, a rationale that discloses multiple layers of meaning. The presentation of these Wurukikanya dreamings in this particular order is based on the mythological root of Jarawara, the clan's founder. His name is on the top. When he created Wurukikanya country, he travels from the southeast, roughly from the southeast of the clan's country through to the northwest. And the route he took is now captured in the Wurukikanya people song cycle. And when Wurukikanya men perform this song cycle, they sing the various themes in the order presented on this slide. On his journey, Jarawara met the dreamings listed in this slide and in this particular order. He first met Stringybark, then Wild Honey, etc., and ended up with Monsoon and Water. And the broken lines depicted in this slide indicates how this dreaming cluster is broken down into subclusters. And the dreamings listed in each subcluster have one thing in common: they share the same natural habitat. The next slide reveals the first layer of meaning I want to present, namely the spatial aspect. The top subcluster include dreamings that are geographically located in the higher eastern parts of the Wurukikanya clan estate, characterized by dry gravel-like country with open eucalyptus forests. And as you can see on this slide, this is the habitat of stringybark, wild honey, and the honeybird called Gekangie. Located in the middle is a subcluster that is more jungle-like, with a dense vegetation where the mythical beings live, spirits and a jungle bird called Judo, jungle fowl. And finally, there is a subcluster located near or in water in the lower parts of the Wurkikanyar estate: cabbage palm, mudcod, bream, northwest monsoon, and water. You may have noticed that I've left out two animals mentioned on this slide, two beings mentioned here. That's crow and possum, but I promise I will get to them as they are very important links between the subclusters I have just described. I believe that the spatial structure underlying these dreaming clusters reveal three layers of meaning. First, there is the geographical location of where these dreamings reside, southeast, middle, and northwest of the country. This southeast-northwest axis, as one of the most important spatial orientations, in significance, I think, comparable with our north-south orientation. And this axis might be based on the two prevailing winds that rain the Arnhem Land seasonal cycle, namely the northwest monsoon and the southeast wind. The second spatial structure reflects the type of habitat where the dreamings reside: high and dry country, the jungle, or in the wetlands. And the third spatial layer of meaning is, which is a little more abstract, is the spatial structure in the axis aerial, terrestrial, and subterranean. Bees and birds belonging to the first, the aerial part of the country. Terrestrial depicts the jungle fowl and spiritual beings running around, and this jungle fowl is a being that can't fly. Just, that's connected to the terrestrial part. And the subterranean, the fish, of course. Next slide. This reveals another layer of meaning linked to each subcluster, namely the seasonal cycle in Arnhem Land, the time aspect. Starting again with species of the first subcluster, the song text of this refer to the start. The song text of the first subcluster refer to the start of the dry season. The stringybark verses, for example, describe how the branches in the stringybark trees, as the song says, sing out and move because of the wind coming from the southern inland. It is also the time when the stringybark flowers. Song texts and mythological accounts at the end of the second subcluster, jungle, and at the beginning of the third refer to the period late in the dry season when the country is much drier and the heat becomes unbearable. These song texts describe the dangerous situation in which various fish, like mudcod and bream, find themselves at the very end of the dry season. There's hardly any water left in the creeks and billabongs, and fish are trapped, facing imminent death. But relief is brought soon by the arrival of the wet season. The next layer, is a bit more abstract. The third principle underlying this cluster of dreamings is the grouping together of species associated with life or with death. Wild honey and the honeybird Gekangie are the dominant dreamings in the clan rituals which symbolize life. And this now is a good time to explain the meaning of crow and possum. Both dreamings symbolize the transition between each subcluster, which is why they are located and presented between broken lines. In certain clan myths, honeybird stands to crow as life to death. Honeybird sits where the stringybark flower blossoms and feeds on nectar. grow, frequents places where rubbish is to be found, and eats rotten food. But crow has an ambiguous character and is not only associated with death, because apart from being found near carcasses, he also likes berries and other fruits, and with his, which is why he is also associated with life. I have worked it out in my paper a bit more in bit more detail. So crow marks the transition from life to death, or the link that exists between life and death in Aboriginal philosophy. In the second cluster, the spirits and the messenger, jungle bird, play important roles in the various death ceremonies. Possum lives in a hollow tree, similar to the last resting place of human bones, in ceremonial hollow logs. So that makes him that connects him with the idea of death, with, as a metaphor of death, but is also ambiguous in nature, as he also feeds on nectar and fruits of cabbage palm trees. And possums are also said to possess great sexual appetite and fertility. He therefore marks the transition to the third subcluster that emphasizes life again. One of the fishes in this subcluster, breamfish, is like the honeybird, an important dreaming in the life symbolic rituals again. It is generally believed in Arnhem Land that the spirits of the unborn children take the form of these fish just before they enter the mother's body. Okay. The next layer in the work, Can Your Dreaming Cluster, reveals two opposites, edible and inedible. As you can see, this opposition runs along the same line as the life-death division. Wild honey is an obvious edible food, but it's also used as medicine and love elixir. And the open forests offer various other kinds of food. The dreamings in this jungle subcluster have nothing to offer here. There is no food to be found, and the people hardly ever visit these rather sinister places. And the songs and myths belong to the third subcluster, focus on edible species again, fish, fruits, plants, shell, etc. We now get to the final layer I present here concerning the organization, and that concerns the organization of the Wurki Kanjar people in two lineages of, or two family groups. The mythical founder of the clan, Jarawar, divided the country into two parts, Gurakne and Nongre. Gurakne meaning neck, a metaphor for the eastern upper part of the clan's estate, and Nongre meaning ankle, which stands for the lower western part of the Wurki Kanjar country. By dividing the estate into a Gurakne and Nongre section, he laid the foundation for the division of the clan in these two lineages. People from the top, Wurki Kanjar Gurakne, and people from the bottom, Wurki Kanjar Nongre. So far my explanation about the various layers of meaning, and I come now to a few conclusions, discussions. The expedition published an impressive series of four volumes, including on Aboriginal art and its related mythological stories on plant ecology and zoology. In the best tradition of Linnaeus taxonomy, it classified a great number of plants and animals in the Arnhem Land region, thus making an invaluable contribution to our Western knowledge of this, and now I quote, almost unknown country, as the introduction of the first volume states. And another important legacy is that the expedition motivated fundamental questions of today. That yesterday was convincingly demonstrated by, for example, the presentation of Professor Ray Specht. However, you could conclude that the expedition, despite its impressive achievements, missed the essence of indigenous taxonomy and its role in structuring space, time, economy, cosmology into a coherent system of knowledge and meaning. And there are two practical circumstances, I think, to explain this. The first is the limited time available for carrying out research in three different locations. Charles Mountford acknowledges this in his contribution on the art of Yirrkala, Volume 1. I quote, "It will be necessary to spend a lengthy period among the Aborigines and to travel extensively over the country before one could gather all the information in relation to language group, the localities, and associated designs." I think he also did a reference to what Ian McIntosh said earlier today about, for example, the language barrier in that period. The second reason why I think it was more difficult for the expedition to grasp this indigenous way of classifying knowledge is the changed context of Aboriginal life in those days, to which Margaret MacArthur refers in her contribution on nutrition in Volume 2. I quote again. She said, "The great majority of the Aborigines in the reserve are thus no longer an autonomous community, but are dependent on the settlement for their livelihood." This situation changed drastically around the 70s of the last century with developments like land rights, the establishment of homeland centres on people's own clan lands, and the simultaneous renaissance in Aboriginal religion activities. Since then, generations of scientists have had plenty of opportunities to spend lengthy periods in Aboriginal bush communities and have been able to travel extensively across indigenous country. And both aspects, extended fieldwork in the setting of homeland centres, have enabled us now to better understand indigenous system of knowledge and classification. But apart from these practical confinements of time and distance, I believe that there may have been a more fundamental reason why the expedition failed to see the essence of the indigenous ways of organizing knowledge. Because notwithstanding the sympathy and the acknowledgement for Aboriginal cooperation, the expedition's approach was firmly based on the dominance of Western scientific paradigms, the indisputable taxonomic traditions. Western scientific paradigms over any other form of knowledge, especially when that type of knowledge was considered primitive. Furthermore, the composition of the expedition, being a combination of distinguished specialists in ethnology, archaeology, zoology, botany, and ornithology, resulted in atomizing Aboriginal knowledge. In my contribution here, I have also concentrated on natural species such as birds, fish, and animals, but have tried to understand, as far as possible from an outsider's view, how Arnhem Land Aborigines structure the natural and social environment, and how they define, with those elements as building blocks, a space, time, cosmology, ecology, according to their own coherent system of classification. And this, the indigenous systems, are the very opposite of atomizing, and instead offer a holistic and meaningful system that permeates all aspects of life. Thank you.
Any questions? Comments?
Hi, Alan Marrett. This is probably a little bit unfair. I suppose you happen to have any recordings of any of those songs about your person.
Beg your pardon?
You don't happen to have any recordings of the songs for this
I've
this
got
series.
Many recordings.
And, but they're not here?
They're not here, no.
They're not here.
Okay. Yes, the Institute on the other side of the road has all the originals. And a couple of years ago, we participated in an amusing recording program where we recorded this song cycle again. And after so many years, I saw the same order of presentation again. And I think one may understand why it has to be presented like this, because it's a kind of grid which contains a lot of information and enables the brain to keep the information, not to forget anything. It's really a kind of virtual, not virtual reality, it's the real world, but it reads from, let's say it simply, it reads from left to right and from up to bottom, from top to bottom. People say sometimes when we sing from top to bottom, meaning we sing from this order. And it's like a grammar of a language. People, you can, on the basis of a certain grammar, you can play with words, but there's a restriction, and the same restriction applies here, that you just can't mix too much of these beings in a song cycle. Use, for example, beings of the first subcluster in the second one or in the third one. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, no, I was just being greedy. I just thought you might have had, on your computer, a sound file. But I guess there are, from the musicological point of view, there are questions about whether some of those the ways in which those categories would be articulated in other aspects, as well as the text, like things like the dance, the type, the types of dance, the sort of unmeasured dances as opposed to measured dances, all the ways that things are marked as being particularly serious or particularly something by the stick beating and all those sorts of things. So I guess there's must be a whole lot of clues there.
Given the time available, I concentrated on the song cycle, but the mythology support the cycle or the other way around. And then you have the dances, which also have to be in a certain order, and paintings. So it's a whole corpus of knowledge. It's not only a song cycle, but I use that as an example.
Mm. Okay, thank you.
Yes, one more, last one.
Thank you, Professor. That was absolutely fantastic. Does that whole comprehensive picture relate just to Indigenous culture within Arnhem Land, or have you done similar work and you've found that it is not just unique to this area but applies in other areas of the Pacific?
No, I've only been in Arnhem Land and mainly working with this group of people, but I know from the neighbouring clans, neighbouring groups, that they have similar constellations of song cycles with similar meanings, but the beings or the elements are different depending on what kind of country people are living in. I mean, living close to the coast, they might have different birds to express the same the same meaning as
but this it would one. Be equally as complex.
I reckon, yeah. Yeah, but it's for me, it's a little bit like explaining, let's say, Einstein in 20 minutes. I couldn't, of course. But it's so interconnected that you just can't take one thing out and leave and forget the others. That's impossible.
Thank you very much. I think
the National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.